sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Dow breaks 17,000. The unemployment rate drops to 6.1. Earnings season starting this week. And our guest today, Jim Bruce, producer, director of the movie Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve. All this and much more on episode number 371 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to this episode to begin July of 2014. Happy Independence Day. We had a great July 4th. Maybe doing some barbecuing. I was up at a wedding up in New York. I got to tell you, it was great. It was kind of interesting. I went out to Brooklyn and spent some time there. I haven't been there in a very long time. Really never spent that much time, even when I lived there in Brooklyn. And it was a really nice event. There's a couple of interesting things. We had some food trucks as the actual caterers for the event. That was great. We had some very good food and good festivities in a very avant-garde kind of place. And one of the things that was really interesting, I thought, was I was introduced firsthand to the whole culture of hipsters. Now, if you don't know what that is, you need to go look at the definition of hipsters and maybe some images of what that is. It kind of like, I don't know, it's people who are semi-anti-establishment, I would think, in a way, yet they're trying really hard and really, really hard to show that they don't care what they kind of look like, matching their clothes. They like to be retro. For example, one of the camera guys even had a Polaroid. I was pretty shocked. They would dress in kind of mismatched clothes, long hair that was quite, unkempt, and sneakers, things like that. Also, one of the things to show how they're retro, you know, their favorite beer. And yeah, favorite beer, I mean, kind of crazy, but if you're a hipster, it seems that you drink Pabst Blue Ribbon, or as they call it, PBR. And I confirmed this with some people. I said, wow, there's Pabst Blue Ribbon going around. Oh, yeah. Hipsters drink that. I said, well, what does that mean? Why not like a Schlitz or something from yesteryear? One of those things, well, it's really cool. It's kind of blue collar, and they like to think of themselves that way. And I don't know. I was pretty astounded on the whole thing, to be honest with you. It didn't make a lot of sense to me why they'd be using, you know, certain cameras and trying to really show this look, this whole image, this aura of not caring. And, you know, but yet at the same time, one of the things I did notice is they were really kind of health conscious, but yet they all smoked. They were all smoking cigarettes. I don't know. If you have some experience with hipsters, I want you to do me a favor. Send me a little note on it at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Pretty interesting stuff, and I really want to understand a little bit more about what this whole cultural issue is. Pretty interesting. Anyway, move on from that, because I can go on for hours. I was staring and watching and asking a lot of questions about what was going on, and got some very weird answers about the whole thing. Let's talk about some of the things that will be coming up next week and the things that we saw last week. First of all, we did see that we had what I thought was a pretty good jobs number, 288,000 or so new people on the payrolls. The unemployment rate dropped to 6.1%. That's good. Very good. A lot of confidence by employers bringing on people. The previous couple of reports were actually revised upward, and that was good. The participation rate, labor participation rate, stayed solid. That's good. So we didn't see any artificial numbers in the unemployment rate really do a lot of goosing of the number in a way that would be otherwise not real. But at the same time, it is still pretty low. It is, labor participation rate is exceptionally low, decades old levels. And that's not really that good because the workforce has shrunk. Now, whether or not that expands, and actually we do see some kind of a change as more people are actually employed and more people are putting on the payrolls, we'll have to see. But one of the things you have to remember is that we did see that really pretty horrendous, that GDP number that was at what, negative 2.8, negative 2.9, depending on how you look at it, I suppose. That number that we saw in the first quarter that kept on getting revised lower and lower, the opportunity to see a much better number in the next quarter is there because we do have employers that are putting on more, seeing that, hey, you know what, things are better. Manufacturing numbers are better. The ISM service number is still holding up very well. And probably some of the reasons why we saw that last quarter, there was the problems with the GDP related to inventory builds or drawdowns, may not be there as much. So if we see manufacturing picking up, and that means that there's going to be some reestablishment of the inventories, that should be good. But really the big thing that we have to look for is coming up is earnings. Next week starts earnings season and usually starts officially, quote unquote, with Alcoa. That's going to be on the 8th of July, and they are coming out after the close of the market, expecting about 12 cents per share in earnings. Now, Alcoa is, they just bought a company. They're doing a lot to really refine their cost structures. And one of the things that has been interesting is that Alcoa started to really come back last quarter after several quarters of misses in terms of really kind of coming in with a okay number, but the markets really didn't like it. Now, since then, we've seen over the last year probably, and even more than that, that the automobile business has really been doing very well. We're hitting some historical levels in terms of sales of cars. We saw that China's really picking up. We saw that the local U.S.-based domestic cars are really selling pretty well. As a matter of fact, the manufacturers are posting some very good numbers. Of course, you have some like GM that has their own little problems. But if you have that kind of situation and dependent on the amount of material that Alcoa supplies to them, it's often somewhat tied to the automobile industry in terms of manufacturing, et cetera, that's a good thing. So Alcoa, we'll see how it goes. Did the stock run ahead of itself or not? Are they going to outperform this 12-cent expectation? Well, we'll see. We also have Family Dollar Stores, but also Wells Fargo is coming out. Wells Fargo is expected to have a $1 EPS, and that's on the 11th. Now, the following week, when we kind of move forward, is where it starts to heat up pretty well. You're going to see a lot more stocks, a lot of banks first in. You're going to see that the banks are really coming in pretty strong over the next week or so, and then technology is going to hit pretty strong as well. So we're going to be watching earnings. Expectations are that earnings will continue to rise. And once again, sales are going to be somewhat flat. Now, I would tell you that if, in fact, we are seeing that confidence is building, and if, in fact, we are seeing that there are more people employed and more spending going on, what you're going to see is that sales numbers are going to pick up. Analysts have been pretty negative on sales for some time, revenue overall for companies. And with many companies raising their prices on their products and with more people being employed, the potential to see a good uptick in sales will be good. Now, companies have been doing a great job at keeping their margins tight. And what's good about that is, you know, if you have increased revenue and you still have a very high level of margin and you cut your expenses to the bone, well, what you're going to find is that companies are going to have better earnings per share. Now, the one monkey wrench would be that the additional cost of human capital that they have now because they've employed so many more people could be a bit of a concern here. But overall, my take here is that companies have been doing this great job of engineering earnings from not only expense cuts, et cetera, but also due to share buybacks. So I think that the potential to see a reasonable quarter is there. Now, whether or not there is some backlash due to the fact that we did see a much better employment number and the fact that now there's some talk that's going on and starting to get a little bit louder and louder that the Fed may actually look to start raising interest rates at a faster pace than they had anticipated is starting to be very concerning. Now, the point here is that by the end of the year, we know that the final level of this QE, at least the bond purchases that they were doing on a regular basis, are going to end. At least that's the plan. And supposedly sometime in the next 6 months after that or so, maybe they're going to raise interest rates. Now, this will be interesting because we will be now one of the countries that will be raising interest rates, whereas we have others around the world and regions that are actually providing stimulus. As an example, the other places that are major are Japan and Europe. Now, remember what you saw when emerging markets had that happen, where you saw that most countries around the world in the developed area were actually lowering rates or providing stimulus, and then you had the emerging markets that were fighting inflation. It wasn't really good for their economies, and it really wasn't good for their stock markets. So let's see how that plays out, you know, whether or not the confidence is there and the run to the larger cap and the run towards safety, which would be the developed countries like the U.S. are going to hold, and maybe we'll see an uptick in emerging markets if this all plays out as it should. Now, one of the things that I did mention last week on DH Unplugged, and I think I've talked about it here very briefly, was the idea that maybe gold would be something to start thinking about, gold and silver. We actually added a position of gold and silver last week. Now, in theory, with the jobs number that we saw, we should see the dollar rising. Okay, fine. And the potential for gold to really sell off. In fact, gold did not really sell off after that. It held very tight. I believe that there is the conscious effort of many investors to start thinking about alternatives to bonds and stocks right now, and there's really not that many aside from cash, and gold, silver, and precious metals may be a play that you want to kind of think about. Commodities have been coming back very strong. You saw the copper really plowed ahead. You saw the palladium is moving, you know, beautifully. And again, with the jobs number, that should have been a safety trade where you say, we don't need any safety here. We don't need any protection. We don't need to worry about things. But I think that if you do combine the fact that you have a better jobs number with the idea that maybe that increases spending and the fact that the Fed is still there, you may start to see an uptick in inflation. It's possible. At the same time, you saw that the IMF over the weekend is once again lowering down their global growth numbers. They're ratcheting them down for the second time in a number of weeks, even with the U.S. as they feel moving higher and into a growth phase. They see that the Europe is really not on a, you know, any kind of level to do anything. And overall, when you look at the year in its entirety and what has happened thus far and considering what they envision to be the next half of the year, they're kind of somewhat negative on that and adjusted their numbers lower. We'll see if anybody pays attention to the IMF at this point. It seems that last time they did the same thing and had a little bit and then just blew it off. Anyway, let's take a break. Let's get to our guest. How about that? And I promise we have a great guest today. We have Jim Bruce, who is the director and producer of the movie Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve. And there's a lot of good things to talk about. I recently watched the movie. I thought it was awesome. Jim, great job, buddy.
Thanks so much. I'm glad you liked the film.
So tell me something. This was done in late 2013. I know it's on DVD now, and also you can get it in different ways, and we'll talk about that in a second. How did you come up with, a simple question, how did you come up with the movie name? I mean, obviously we know about the printing press and all that, but what was the, you know, you had all sorts of choices, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, in telling the story, you're always looking for sort of a title that sort of helps to encapsulate, you know, what the film is about. And ultimately, you know, if you look at the recovery we've had the last few years, it's really based on the Fed and on this idea that the Fed is going to backstop asset prices with their ability to print money, you know, out of thin air. So Money for Nothing seemed to be the perfect way to sort of describe, you know, not just the film, but it's sort of really the sort of stage that we're, you know, it's the world we're living in right now, it's being driven by whether it's the ECB or the Fed, you know, central banks around the world creating money out of thin air. So it just seemed like the right title for the time.
Now, you seem like a young guy. I mean, how old are you? In range. Give me a range.
I'm in my late 30s.
Okay. So the money for nothing concept, I mean, you know, does this also bleed over into the whole idea of the entitlement generation?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. I mean, towards the end of the film, we look at the impact Fed policies have had on our sort of culture and our society. I think we saw it with the stock boom in the 90s. We saw it with the housing and almost everything boom in the mid-2000s. I think we're seeing it again with this sort of QE boom we're living in. So we do touch on how the Fed, you know, Fed's trying to change people's behavior with their policies. They're really trying to provide incentives to do one thing and not another. The incentive is to borrow if you're a household, you know, to take out, you know, to refinance, to buy a bigger house, to buy a car, that kind of thing. If you're a business, the incentive is to lever your balance sheet, to borrow cheaply. So the Fed is trying to change people's behaviors with their policies. And we do touch on that in the film. I mean, the question we ask is, you know, in the short term, we understand why the Fed is trying to sort of boost things with their policies, but do these policies work in the long term? Or in the long term, are we all going to be in some ways worse off because of these short-term minded policies the Fed's been pushing on us really at this point for well over a decade?
Yeah, I mean, you say short term. I mean, it's been 5 years of pedal to the metal or so. And it's funny because just recently we saw that there was an article that came out or some kind of a news story about how Facebook was actually doing some kind of story. I guess they were placing certain stories and certain things in front of different people and testing what their reactions would be. It kind of reminds me of what a bit of the Fed. I feel sometimes with the Fed a bit of a rat in a cheese maze. You know, they're leading me around a little bit.
Or a lot. Well, and a lot of, you know, one of the questions we get from people, like after screenings, people say, we have Q&As in different areas. You know, sometimes I've been at the screening, sometimes I'm appearing via Skype. And people say, well, what do I do with my money? And if you think about it, the Fed has created this, you know, if you've been taking risk, you know, hand over fist and levering for the last 5 or 6 years, it's obviously been a great time for you.
Yeah.
But in general, for the average investor who has a little bit of an awareness of history, the Fed has created a really difficult situation where you could argue stocks and bonds are overpriced, not priced to deliver long-term solid returns. And the question is, you know, how long does this game go on? And should you take risk if everyone who's taking risk is getting paid well, you know, it recently and for the last few years. And so it's creating a really difficult situation. And I really think they are playing with people's emotions and people's behavior. And I think what we've seen in the markets is kind of this feedback loop of every time it looks like the market's, you know, going to go down or correct, you know, people just make this assumption that, well, you can't be in anything else but stocks. The Fed's going to back us up. We have David Tepper in the film describing this idea that I think is really in the markets, this collective belief that the Fed won't let the market go down. And I think one of the things we point out in the film is that that's what people thought in the late 90s. That's what people thought in the mid-2000s. There's sort of nothing new about this, and it is something that I think the average investor should be wary of, this sort of influence the Fed is trying to have on them, you know, trying to get them to take more risk than they might otherwise take. That doesn't always end well.
Well, it's interesting. Listen, let's I think, talk about this. And I've said this, and my audience hears this all the time from me, but so the banks took all the risk back in the day, right? You know, and the banks, by the way, this is not the first collapse we've seen in banks, not the second, not the third, not the, I can't name how many we've had either.
Goes back through history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's an old history, especially with real estate.
Right. You know? Exactly. It's a long history, exactly. But so now, back in the day, when or any of these times when the banks would collapse post when the central bank was formed, you know, central bank or the government would bail them out or would at least do something in the financial system to stabilize it, et cetera. But there was a backstop, you know? The big question I have is, so if the banks were backstopped by the central bank, which was the last lender or lender of last resort, who, aside from God, backs up the central bank? Or is there even a need for that?
Well, I think that's the question. I think the Fed has taken things to an extreme in playing their role. Because, you know, you could say we did have a financial crisis, but for the last 4 or 5 years, we haven't been in a state of crisis. You know, the economy has been growing, the stock market has been booming. But the Fed has sort of kept these kind of emergency policies in place, you know, long after the crisis. And you could argue, and I would, that the Fed is really, they're using their powers to the point where I think the next question will be, you know, because if you look at how the crises have gone, in the 90s, it was the stock market, which is not as big of a deal as in the mid to late 2000s when it became the financial system as a whole was at risk. And the Fed has backstopped that. And the only thing, you know, supporting the Fed is people's trust and confidence in the U.S. dollar and the U.S. government. And I think, you know, the concern that we raise in the film is that the sort of next problem is going to be to have something to do with people's confidence either in the U.S. dollar or the U.S. government, because nobody's bigger than the market. And the Fed and the U.S. government, by borrowing trillions and trillions of dollars, the Fed by printing trillions and trillions of dollars, have sort of, they made the last crisis go away. But the problem is that sowing seeds for the next crisis, because there's just no, I mean, if you just look at history, there's no example of a country that's just continued to print money out of thin air and borrow for these big deficits, you know, endlessly. At some point, you know, the rubber meets the road.
But one of the things you could say, though, is that historically we were the ones that really did that at an extreme. You didn't really see that in Europe as much. You didn't see it in Asia, except for Japan. Japan's, you know, in the last 20-something years. And what's interesting now is that the race to the bottom with currencies, which used to be really the place that the U.S. would be involved with for the most part in terms of any kind of, you know, use of their dollar for exports, et cetera, is now spread throughout the world. It's become an acceptable way of doing things. And what's really interesting is if everybody is devaluing their currency, doesn't that mean that everybody is not devaluing their currency?
Everything is relative, like Einstein said. And I think the analogy I use is that, you know, I think of with Japan printing as much as they are and the European Central Bank and the U.S., and these are all the major, the entire developed world. And then you look at the Asian exporter countries. They want a weaker currency to help their exports. So the entire developed world and really the entire emerging world, everyone's trying to devalue their currency at the same time. And so it's like speeding trains that are all going, you know, 200 or 199 miles an hour. If you look over the train next to you, it seems nobody thinks anybody's going that fast. And I think that's one of the problems with the Fed being the world reserve currency, sort of setting the benchmark for global central banks. If the Fed has, you know, Fed's had 0% interest rates, they've been, you know, essentially trying to destroy our currency for the last 5 or 6 years. So with the Fed setting that benchmark and everyone following, there's no anchor to the global monetary system. And one of the guys in the film who's Bill White is a famous, you know, economist, a big figure from the Bank for International Settlements. So as sort of senior a figure as you can be in the central banking world, give speeches at Jackson Hole and everything, you know, one of the things he said to me was one of the problems with our international monetary system is there really isn't one. You know, we have a system that's based on the dollar as a reserve currency, but the U.S. is as a share of global GDP is getting smaller and smaller, and yet we're trying to control this giant system by using our interest rates, using our quantitative easing policies. And so there really is no anchor. You know, in the 19th century, 18th century, 17th century, we had gold. And one could argue that this experiment with pushing things, you know, with money becoming more and more abstract, money for nothing, quantitative easing, you know, these policies that have sort of never really been tried before, that we're getting away from any kind of tangible support for this system that we're sort of pushing to greater and greater extremes.
So I let me interrupt you because I want to make sure we get a lot in here, okay? And again, the movie is Money for Nothing, Inside the Federal Reserve. And here's what I have. You know, there's the producer and the director. There's the guy. So first question, then I want to go through the movie. How did you get access to all these players? I mean, we're talking about going back to Volcker and Bernanke and Yellen. I mean, I kind of tried to think about, did you use tapes? Did you put it together? Did you actually have access? Because they were all black backgrounds and all that, so you must have actually interviewed these people. How did you get that access?
Yeah, we interviewed basically everyone that we wanted to besides Greenspan and Bernanke, not surprisingly. But we did get Paul Volcker, Janet Yellen, a lot of current and former Fed officials, and then you know, outsiders and some very strong critics. And some of the critics are at the Fed. That was the hardest thing about making the film, was trying to get access, because I didn't want to make a film that just had, you know, sort of outsider Fed critics saying everything that's wrong with the Fed. I felt like it would be much stronger if we had the perspective of people inside the Fed. And what's sort of surprising for most people when they see the film is how critical some current and former Fed officials are. You know, Paul Volcker essentially, you know, acknowledges that the Fed played a huge role in the housing bubble and it was a big boom and a big bust and kind of a disaster. And so I felt like that would just make the film, you know, we didn't want it to just preach to the choir of people who want to get rid of the Fed and are very critical of the Fed and just have those figures, and someone could dismiss it as, oh, these are all, you know, these are all outsiders. They don't, you know, they're not experts in the field. So we really put together, you know, an amazing
great cast. And
it was hard. We had to be persistent. A lot of, you know, a lot of meetings, a lot of interviews, a lot of meeting people before they were in the film to try to convince them and make them comfortable with what I was doing. And one of the interesting things about the Fed is you see it in the news in recent months. It is a government institution that does allow essentially its top officials to disagree with each other publicly. So you have people in the film like Charles Plosser, Tom Honig, Richard Fisher, who've all been very critical of policy in recent years. And that's a healthy thing. And it's one of the things we wanted to emphasize in the film, is that not everyone at the Fed has been wanting to do what they've done. There's been a lot of people warning about it. And so we wanted to give voice to those people. And I think in the spirit of that, they were willing to participate. And you know, we were lucky to get everyone that we did get.
You know, what's interesting is today you have these disagreeing parties inside the Fed, right? But what you do notice is that the ones that disagree with the Fed are the non-voting.
That's the tricky part.
You
really see it in the film.
It's so stupid. There's this
difference between, and it tends to be, and there's a reason for it, you know, back in the day when the Fed was founded in 1913, all the regional banks, there's 12 of them around the country, had the vote when the committee met, you know, every so often to what they do now is set interest rates. Back then it wasn't as simple as that. But everyone got a vote, all these regional bank presidents. And in the wake of the Great Depression, there was this idea that indecision at the Fed had sort of made the Great Depression worse. So they took the vote away and they made it rotating for regional bank presidents. So regional bank presidents, only five of them vote out of the 12 any one year. And so the voices that you see in the film, Jeff Lacker, the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, Tom Honig, Kansas City, Charles Plosser, Philadelphia, those guys are really only voting once every 3 years. They've been critics, but they don't have quite as much power as the, and they're also not political appointees. So the political appointees are the governors of the Federal Reserve, and the chair and the vice chair, people like Janet Yellen. They tend to be, you know, coincidence or not, they tend to be the people that are wanting lately to push the boundary, to print more money, to not worry about inflation. And they essentially have a little bit more power because they have more votes.
Yeah. So you talk about Jekyll Island and the secret meeting that was done in the early 1900s, or it was a meeting that they had.
Yep.
And it was secret.
Yep.
What is your take on that from everything that you've investigated and maybe some of the discussions you have? Was it all about just, you know, protecting the rich, or was it, and why did it have to be secret?
Well, that's the question. I mean, if we talk about the Fed as having sort of been born as a conspiracy,
right?
You know, in the sense that, so this was Jekyll Island was a meeting in 1910. It was organized by Senator Nelson Aldrich, and they basically gathered representatives of the major banks of the time, the sort of, you know, what we would think of as the big too big to fail organizations, the J.P. Morgans and Citibanks and whatnot. They traveled under false names. They traveled in his private railroad car to an island off the coast of Georgia to have this meeting. And of course, word got out later on. And of course, you know, suspicion about the Fed began then and continues to today.
Right.
I mean, my take on it is I don't think the Fed always was the Fed's role has really changed over the years. And I think it's only been in recent years that the Fed has really become what I think people feared it would become when it was first founded. And we had some people don't realize we had central banks previously in this country, right after the revolution, and up through the early 19th century, we had two central banks, the first and the second. And they were both discontinued because there was this idea that they weren't serving the general populace, that they were basically serving the interests of the wealthy and the politically connected. And I think one of the concerns we raise in the film is that especially in recent years with quantitative easing, with the Fed explicitly under Bernanke, you know, talking the stock market up, taking a position and, you know, buying all these mortgages, trillions of dollars now of mortgages, you know, getting involved in a specific sector of the economy. That's, you know, in our view, that's an overreach. And the Fed quantitative easing is making the rich richer, just by definition. Anybody who owns financial assets is going to be one of the wealthiest. You know, it's going to be part of the wealthiest.
And then we have the government complaining about. Then we have them complaining about. You know, this whole
problem.
It's unbelievable.
So I worry that the Fed's kind of become that creature from Jekyll Island, yeah, in the sense that they're really trying to control financial markets. When the Fed was first created, it was much more narrow, the idea of what it was going to do. We were supposed to be on the gold standard. The Fed wasn't even at that time supposed to control inflation, because the idea was that gold would simply do that by having the dollar backed by gold. So it was a really narrow reason to create the bank, the Federal Reserve, and that was for banking panics. I think you could argue there is a reason to have a central bank just for to be a lender of last resort during banking panics. But now we have the Fed sort of ostensibly calling the shots in the stock market and the mortgage market, so effectively the housing market, and the government bond market, which is the largest market in the world. So you really have the Fed becoming this sort of central planner, and you could look at its policies as really explicitly benefiting the most wealthy. I don't think that's what Janet Yellen is intending to do, but the reality is that's what she's doing.
Well, she's protecting her portfolio. But she has a bond portfolio that if they did let the cat out of the bag, that there is inflation and they were going to slow down and raise interest rates, there could be a significant run. Now, listen, they even talked about a few weeks ago possibly doing a redemption fee on bond funds, which was absurd. But that kind of situation is all because they're trying to protect it. By the way, two things. I still like the days of Greenspan because I found it fascinatingly enjoyable to try to decipher what he was saying. Because I listened to him, and it was more than Fed speak. It was something from another planet. He was like channeling something from somewhere when he would do. He obviously sat with a thesaurus and did whatever he can to bring up the most confounding phrases. And I thought it was fabulous because, you know, it was you knew he was purposely trying to do it versus where you're trying to do it underhandedly, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, I have a question for you. So a few years ago, I looked at, okay, well, what's the deal with the Fed and these guys and what can they own and what they can't? You know, we hear about the blind pools for the government, for the president of the United States, et cetera. You know, it is my understanding from what I saw that the Fed officials can actually own equities. Are you aware of this?
I don't know the details. I think they're allowed to own maybe what they own going in, like similar to other politicians, and they're probably not allowed to trade or something like
right.
that.
So
I actually don't know the fact there. If you know them, I'd
well, I saw that there was some big old like variable annuity with equity exposure for Bernanke at one time, and I'm thinking to myself, let me think about this. So he's
retiring soon, right?
Right. He's not going to do anything that's really going to shake the boat for that. Now, I got that. I understand that we want things to do well, and I understand that we want the economy to do well and all that. But, you know, at the same time, I would much prefer, just for the sake of it, to have my officials that are making any kind of monetary decisions that will affect either a sector or entire economy or anything to have a blind pool, frankly. I don't think they should have any sway because, you know what, you're going to sit there and go, well, if I lower rates, if I raise rates, well, how's that going to affect my portfolio? Listen, I don't want to really whack rates. I got a lot of bonds going on there or something, or whatever, you know? What was your favorite interview or most interesting?
I mean, Volcker, I think, is that, you know, he's a huge figure, literally and figuratively, six foot eight. He, you know, when I was interviewing him, you know, I just realized, like, here's a man who has a lot of wisdom and has, you know, has a perspective that I think we could really use in this country, which is he was someone that worried about the long term, that worried about the big picture. He was not the kind of guy that cared at all. And I think this is the type of person you need at the Fed. What happened to the stock market for the next couple of quarters? You know, he was thinking about the big picture. And if you look at when Volcker took office in 1979, inflation was at something like 13%. There was, you know, we had gone off the gold standard. There was this sense that the dollar was going to lose all its value, that the U.S. government was going to default. You know, New York City had just recently gone to the brink of bankruptcy. And he really sort of restored faith and confidence in our system, in our dollar, in our government. And he did that by causing a lot of short-term pain in places like the stock market and the housing market. And he was unpopular in the short run, but he sort of set up set us up for a great period, I think bought a lot of time for the Fed and for the U.S. government and for the U.S. economy. And I think, in recent years, we haven't really lived up to that,
right?
To I think, that standard. And so we're sort of squandering, I think, the confidence the world has in our currency and in our government.
But at the end of the day...
And we're kind of going back to that place that he, where he had to come in and save the day.
Well, but if you look back on that time, whatever that time period is, and you look at what we're doing now and you say, well, there's no inflation. One of the things, you look at shadow stats or even just look at the calculations. I mean, what's the movie? The Jerry Lewis movie? Don't raise the bridge, lower the water. Or if you have a drinking water fountain in some city that does no longer makes the quality exam. All right, we'll change the level of testing requirements. It seems that's what's gone on. You have a situation where banks don't meet their criteria. Okay, we'll just give you 3 more months. Or you have a situation where inflation. I don't know about you, but you're in California, right? So.
Yeah, we're all paying for California gas.
Right. And you're going to get a little bit of a reduction now in your taxes coming up. But besides that, everything costs more. And we have this notion that there's no inflation, so they can keep on doing what they're doing. We have this participation rate. We have all these different ways of calculating to make things look a certain way. What's included, what's not included. So now we're saying, oh, there's no inflation or there's no, real rise in prices. Or, you look at how they've done things to now look at the allowable assets that may be included on a balance sheet, et cetera. They're doing all these crazy things. Listen, how about at the height of the crisis where they changed the accounting rules to look at, what was an asset that can be included or not and how they can, and all of a sudden you're like, well, just put the bad assets aside and now you're looking better.
Yeah.
And to even Italy, where they can include prostitution and drugs in the GDP.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that we point out in the film is that part of the reason the Fed didn't see these problems coming is, for example, they weren't looking at house prices and inflation in the early to mid 2000s. They knew low interest rates were influencing the housing market, but their measure of inflation didn't include housing prices. So, which is a huge portion of what was going on at the time. So the Fed, just has a history of being out of touch with what's really happening. In terms of what's going on right now, the Fed views it as just short-term noise, the rise in oil prices and things like that. But I think we're getting to the point in the labor market where we may begin to see sustainable, self-reinforcing inflation. And the Fed, it thinks and says, oh, if we start to see inflation, we'll deal with it. But it's really been an incredibly long time since the Fed has actually tried to fight off inflation. We had a big bout of it in 2007 and 2008, and that was one of the reasons the Fed was slow to deal with the crisis. But I think, the Fed is really, really going to have a difficult time dealing with inflation with their balance sheet where it is right now, with interest rates at 0%. And having kept them there so long, we have an economy that can't handle higher interest rates. So I think the Fed's really kind of put themselves in a tight
spot. Yeah, and potentially they're a little bit too confident, right?
Yeah, I mean, the history, and we try to point it out in the film, Fed officials never say, we don't know. They never sort of admit, we're not sure what we're doing. They always sort of, project confidence.
And how often are they right?
They're wrong.
Right, they're wrong.
If you look at their forecast, even starting in 2007, they said, growth will be back next year,
right.
2008.
Right.
And every year since then, they forecast growth, of 3 or 4%. Sort of right around the corner, and every year they've been wrong. This year, is no exception. And so one of the points we try to make in the film is that the Fed shouldn't be in the business of trying to forecast things or trying to steer individual markets or change asset prices, because they're not smart enough to understand those things. They should be looking at the very core simple thing that central bank can do, which is we want to maintain the value of our currency, and that's just and keep people's confidence in our system, and that's about all the Fed should be doing. But what they're really trying to do is drive the economy with these big asset booms, and we've seen them fail. We saw it fail in 2000, 2007. And one of the things we point out is this, we're back in the same place that we were. We're doing the same policies. They're having the same effect on markets and investors. I think so many people realize that this isn't going to end well. The question is, what's the catalyst? When is the market going to break? But this idea that the market is going to go up forever because these people at the Fed are so smart and so willing to sort of make it happen, I think is a myth.
Well, the one big thing also is, and I'll end on this, that if you look back any year in history and you look at where we are in terms of the nominal GDP, and you look at where we are in terms of the labor market, and you look at where we are, because there's a lot of different factors on the labor market, but you look at where we are in total manufacturing, et cetera, and then you would say, well, hey, you don't know where it is. I'm going to blindfold you. What should the interest rate policy be? Where are we?
Yep.
You wouldn't say 0%. You wouldn't say 0.25. Maybe say, maybe 2.5. Something. It's absurd how long they're holding on to this. And, I agree that it is in effect, it's giving a good feeling to people to, try to put money in. It also, we can't deny that it really does bring up speculation on a global basis. And, it's happening not only here, but it's happening in the ECB, where they just did the negative deposit rates and $25 billion came out in a day. Where that money's going, I don't know. It'd be much better for the Fed, seriously, to give everybody 10 grand and be done with it. Because then we know there's a limit to it. Just, all right, here's your 10 grand. Save it. Do what you want with it. Put it in. Don't. And yes, companies are doing better, but a lot of it is because they're doing mergers and acquisitions, which is good, but because it's low interest rates. They're paying back dividends. People like that because where else are you going to get yield? Okay, that's good. They're buying back their stock. I question that because they doubled down on their deal. It's good from earnings, but you could really run into trouble long term on that if things don't work out. But you know what? What happens when the lighter fluid ends and you have this smoldering piece of wood that you need to ignite itself. And I mean, that's what you're saying. You need organic growth. And that's the one thing that I think people have no idea how to do anymore.
Yeah. And to some degree, it's because we've sort of been relying on growth in the financial sector to make up for a lack of growth elsewhere since the 90s. In the 90s, it was the stock market. Then it was stock and housing. Now it's kind of a little bit of everything.
Right.
But it's not, and the Fed isn't sort of willing. And to me, this is sort of the hubris of people in power, or in part the problem is we're asking them, there is a mandate from Congress to make the economy grow faster and to have this thing, that Congress calls full employment. So we're asking the Fed to make the economy grow faster, but yet the Fed doesn't really have any actual economic powers. They just have the ability to influence financial markets and financial asset prices. So it's like we're trying to achieve the end of a healthier growing economy, through financial markets. And so, but what we have is subsidized, overpriced, we have this, casino on steroids, of a financial market. And none of this is really translating to growth, in the economy generally, as we saw with the most recent GDP or with making things better for the average person, because the average person doesn't really have much invested in the stock market, might not have much home equity, and all they're seeing is higher prices at the gas pump and higher food prices. The average person is actually getting squeezed, but if you're a billionaire, you're doing great.
Sitting back and enjoying yourself. So,
and that's why we got rid of the first two central banks, literally, is because there was this sense that they were just helping out the wealthy and the politically connected. And I think the Fed should be concerned about that in the long run, this idea that they're really propping up financial markets sort of to some degree at the expense of the rest of the population.
Yeah. And anybody who's listening to this right now and you say, oh my God, this guy's nuts. Andrew, you're nuts. You know what? The fact is that think about it for a second. Just step back for 1 second and think about what's being said here. And again, maybe not today, tomorrow, maybe not another month, but realize that, with the long-term capital management bailout and some of the precedent that was set, the fact that, with combination of banks getting involved much more, with having money being bailed out, getting involved in investments, which has been returned a bit by the Volcker Rule, there's something just not quite right about having to base all your investment decisions on Fed action. And regardless of economics, like a negative 2.9% GDP, what's the big deal? It's only weather. I mean, I don't care what you call it, but the carving out of this whole and couching of this whole economics that are based on the Fed, that's just not a healthy way to really run a portfolio long term or to have your own investments, because it's not going to be there forever. It just can't be. And if it is there forever, we have a bigger problem. Let's just get to that.
Exactly. I mean, it really is central planning, if you think about it. We know that central planning hasn't worked every time it's been tried. And we became the wealthiest country in the world and in world history, really in the 19th century. But by the time the Fed was founded in 1913, we were already the wealthiest country in the world. So we did it all without a central bank, without a PhD from anywhere planning any of this stuff.
Right.
And markets work. We know that. But somehow, in response to 2007 crisis, I understand the need to deal with a crisis and not have a total collapse of the financial system. And we cover that in the film. The Fed was instrumental there in preventing just a total breakdown. But since then, we've built back a system, as you say, that is directly reliant on Fed policy and the sort of psychology that it creates in markets. And that's not how you become wealthier.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Tell us how to get the film. Tell us how our folks, because I know you can get it online.
Yeah. On our website, moneyfornothingthemovie.org. The film's available for DVD. Film's available as a DVD and Blu-ray. We do plan later this year to be out in a few other formats, like Netflix, iTunes, that kind of thing.
And it's still showing in some theaters around, right?
Yeah. We're still having screenings. A lot of we've been in theaters around the country and internationally, but also a lot of financial offices and universities have been having screenings in recent months, and we're continuing to do that.
Well, that's great. Well, I'll direct everybody to your site, moneyfornothingthemovie.org. A nice compact name. And listen, I really appreciate you coming on. Very enlightening and excellent job.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Okay.